This is Jerry Newcomb, and we are now shifting gears and talking with John West. John West is with the Discovery Institute, and he has put together a book called The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. And this book is actually produced by the Discovery Institute. John West, thank you for being on the program.
Jerry, thanks for having me.
Sure. C.S. Lewis is such a great Christian writer, probably the greatest Christian writer of the 20th century, perhaps of all time, other than what we find in the Bible. But I understand his book sold something like 200 million copies. That's great for a Christian writer.
And counting. They're still selling, but
yeah.
You're right. It's just phenomenal.
Now, some people get the impression from some of the things C.S. Lewis said that he bought into the whole evolutionary system. Is that true?
No, it's not. He, of course, evolution is a word that means many different things, so we do need to sort of be a little bit careful there. Basically, the modern theory means two big things. One, we come from one universal common ancestor, so the idea that human beings, apes, and fungi all came from the same source. And then two, the way we developed was through an unguided, unplanned process of basically survival of the fittest, acting on these random genetic mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis, actually as a Christian, thought that a Christian could believe that we came from a common ancestor, so he wasn't, although he himself, as his life went on, became more skeptical of the evidence for that. In fact, when the Piltdown Man hoax came out that was supposed to be a common ancestor with us and the apes that turned out to be a fraud, he found that quite amusing and, in fact, predicted that it was a hoax before it was actually unveiled as a hoax. But when it came to the unguided natural selection, he was sharply critical of that and never thought you could get things like the human mind or morality or even the finely tuned complexity we find throughout nature from an unguided, unplanned, mindless process. And he came to this, actually, interestingly, even before he was a Christian. World War I, he was wounded, as many people might know, on the front lines, and as he was recovering from shrapnel wounds, he actually read a book by a French Nobel laureate that was called Creative Evolution that was support evolution in a sense, but was very down on Darwin's theory of it being an unguided, undirected process and pointing out that natural selection can't choose for future form or function. And Lewis found that really a devastating critique. So later in his life, he even referred to that, that critique of orthodox Darwinism was really hard to answer. And so that was very convincing to him, even while he was still an atheist.
Let me ask you a question. Here we are all these years later from the publishing of that particular book you refer to, not the one by C.S. Lewis, but the one that influenced him in the 1920s. Is that still of value, that book?
Actually, it is, because I'd say the fundamental problems with natural selection have only gotten greater, but some of the fundamental problems of how do you get finely tuned, organized complexity of whole systems through an unguided, unplanned process based on mistakes is still with us and really has not been answered.
Well, then do me a favor. Say the name again of that book that was influential to him.
Sure. Creative Evolution by Henri Bergson. And we write about this in the book The Magician's Twin and in the companion video. Actually, it's a fascinating story, too, because one of the things we did in this book that no one has done before is go to Lewis's personal library. He had dozens of books about science and many of them about evolution, and he loved to write annotations and underlining in these books. And so for the first time, we actually went and transcribed these things and report on.
Neat.
In fact, this book, Creative Evolution, it's more than 400 pages. Virtually every page has annotations in English in a book that's actually, he was reading in French.
Wow.
It was translation, but it was really fascinating to read.
Now, was this at Wheaton College by chance?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I went to Wheaton Graduate School, and you can actually see the wardrobe that C.S. Lewis had when he was little, and that of course was the inspiration for the wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and so forth. Now, going back before we forget the subject of Piltdown Man, because I think this is fascinating. I was thinking about it this the other day. I was thinking about all the supposed evidence for evolution. The evolutionists, of course, don't believe that man evolved from apes. Evolutionists believe that man and apes evolved from the same ancient hominids.
Yep.
But Piltdown Man would be one of those, you know, in the sequence where you have essentially the skull of a human being with the jaw of an ape, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, but that was a deliberate hoax. Is there anything other than Piltdown Man that actually argues for evolution in progress?
Oh, that's a bad question. I'd say it's a growth industry, and every year they claim something, and then about 5 years later, you have other scholars, even who are evolutionists, who basically say, well, that wasn't what we expected. And so on the human side, of course, the famous thing that actually here in Seattle, we had the remnants of Lucy that were just literally a few fragments pieced together and artfully reconstructed, where there's huge debates, even among evolutionists, about was this actually somewhere, you know, in our ancestry or not. In fact, there's another book published just this year, if people are fascinated about that, called Science and Human Origins, just a small book by biologist Ann Gager and Doug Axe and Casey Luskin that actually goes in to the purported ancestors today that are cited and just shows how arguable, how fragmentary, how evolutionists themselves can't agree because the evidence is so slight and so fragmentary.
Now, was there some sort of reason that you decided to write this book about C.S. Lewis? Was there some catalyst event?
Sure. Well, one, I have loved Lewis for a long time, ever since my sister, when I was in grade school, gave me the Chronicles of Narnia. And I've done stuff on Lewis before, edited an encyclopedia about him. But then there are a lot of people from Francis Collins, the famous geneticist, to theologian Michael Peterson, who have basically said, well, C.S. Lewis, if he lived today, would be an opponent of intelligent design, and he was just an overall booster of Darwinian theory. And that's so far from the truth that I wanted to set the record straight. And in the process, I had to go a lot deeper into some of Lewis's unpublished writings and annotations and things that actually fill out the story that hasn't been told before.
Now, wait, let me ask you a question. When it comes to people who believe in theistic evolution, in a sense, are they not proponents of intelligent design? Because, I'm serious, they are basically saying that there's this intelligence in the universe, let's call him God, that's directing all this.
Yeah, you know, it really depends on how you define theistic evolution, just like how you define evolution. If you simply mean evolution is common ancestry and that God didn't use that process and directed it, yes, actually, I'd say that you could both believe in intelligent design and a type of evolution. But the majority theory of evolution, sort of the mainstream theory, is not just common ancestry. It's that it was an unguided, undirected process. So if you're going to be a theist and embrace that, which most the major leading proponents of theistic evolution, say like Ken Miller at Brown University, theologian John Hott at Georgetown, you have to do some fancy footwork. And basically what they say is, well, evolution is genuinely undirected, but we do believe in God, so God himself doesn't know how it's going to turn out. Huh. I actually once had a public debate on school policy with Ken Miller where he said, yeah, that meant that evolution could have produced a big brain dinosaur or a thinking clam or human beings, and God didn't know which. So, and this type of theistic evolution, the sort of trying to square, having a circular square, or, you know, is really logically incoherent. And Lewis, although he thought Christians could believe in a type of common ancestry, although even there he had some caveats, but he, on the unguided stuff, for Christians who tried to square unguided evolution with theism, he thought that was logically incoherent, and he actually was very critical of that. This is actually another one of the books he read in the last year or two of his life, was Pierre Teilhard de Chardin's book, The Phenomenon of Man, which in Lewis's lifetime was probably one of the preeminent texts by a theistic evolutionist. And Lewis wrote all sorts of very critical comments in that book, and actually to his private letters to people about how this was incoherent. Either things were directed by a mind or they weren't. And if you're trying to talk about an evolutionary process that sort of strives for things but isn't directed by a mind, that's incoherent. I mean, it's either directed by a mind or it's not. If it's directed by a mind, then it is actually designed, and it's not an unguided process. You can't square the circle.
Are there direct statements from C.S. Lewis that, let's say, the other side would point to and say, look, this proves he believed in evolution? And vice versa. Are there direct statements that our side could point to and say, look, he didn't believe in evolution?
Yeah, I think you know the best statements that they can cite on the other side is where Lewis said, as a Christian, he didn't object in principle to common ancestry, although he went on to say that he did think Christians need to insist that the first human beings were morally innocent and had a genuine fallen history, which is another thing that most theistic evolutionists have a problem with because they can't square that with standard evolutionary theory. But so Lewis does say that he doesn't object in principle as a Christian to common ancestry, even though he doesn't really take a stand on whether he believed it was true and later in life became more skeptical. But you can cite that from The Problem with Pain, for example. But then on the other side, we have, you know, the earliest statement actually was a letter he wrote to his dad shortly after reading this book by Creative Evolution by Henri Bergson, where he talks about Darwin being built on sand, on gigantic assumptions and irreconcilable, you know, beliefs that you really don't hold together. And that was, he wrote that in the 1920s. And then near the end of his life, he wrote to a prominent evolution critic who was one of the friends of his, called Bernard Ackworth, who helped lead something called the evolution protest movement in Britain at the time, where he actually talked about evolution being this, you know, the most important lie or the radical falsehood that's basically through everything. And so, you know, there certainly are some things. And actually, in the last book Lewis wrote before he died, called The Discarded Image, which is an academic scholarly book about the Middle Ages, but has a fair amount about the nature of scientific revolutions, he goes out of his way to point out in the epilogue that, in his view, the Darwinian revolution in biology didn't come about, as he said, because of the discovery of new facts. In his view, it was because people saw what they wanted to see.
Mm.
That's pretty devastating. That was basically his final word on the final book he wrote before he died.
And he died about 50 years ago, actually, from the month that this program is being recorded. I'm Jerry Newcomb.
He was born, and tomorrow is his birthday, or he was born on November 29th.
Right, and this is actually being pre-recorded. It'll air next week, but John West is with us right now. He edited a new book called The Magician's Twin. It's C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and let's continue with this discussion on C.S. Lewis. I wanted to ask you about his view of science in the sense that he saw the potential where science could be used in evil ways. In fact, he used an analogy that science is, in the early days of science, it was like a little lion cub, real cute and, you know, friendly and so forth. But as it grows up, and it learns to taste and like human blood, you know, then it becomes a dangerous beast.
Yes. And I want to make clear, Lewis was not anti-science. He appreciated the findings of science, actually wrote about how the Judeo-Christian worldview helped lead to some, you know, key things in science. But he thought it could be abused and misused.
Right.
And so he was very concerned about that, or what sometimes people call scientism. And our book, The Magician's Twin, is as much about the overall issue of the abuse of science as it is about particular topics like, say, evolution.
Sure.
And Lewis had a lot to say on that. He did think that science, when it was fused together with sort of this materialist paradigm that we're just blind matter in motion, ends up deconstructing human beings into basically automatons, you know, that we don't have free will, we don't have personal responsibility. It, you know, devalues religion. It says morality is just, you know, the evolving product of what takes to survive. And he thought, and wrote in his novels, in books like that, his strength, one of his novels, books like The Abolition of Man, he really critiqued that. And really, he was a prophet, I think, on this issue, because this is still with us today. This abuse of science to, as the be-all, end-all, not just as something good, but as the only way of knowing anything about the world, about morality, about any ultimate things, that you have to do it through science. And then the claim that only people who are scientific experts then have the right to tell us how public policy should operate and what we should do, how government should operate, what we can and cannot do. Lewis was very concerned about what he called the rise of scientocracy. And I think you see that all around us today.
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, C.S. Lewis used to be a professor at Oxford, then later Cambridge. But there's a professor at Oxford right now named Dr. Julian Savulescu, who's Romanian-born, and he's basically advocating that parents have their children while they're in utero. In other words, embryos, unborn babies, if there's some sort of potential moral defect supposedly within the baby, have them altered. In fact, he's written articles. These are actual titles of scientific articles that he's presented. New Breeds of Humans, quote, The Moral Obligation to Enhance. Why, and here's another one, why I believe parents are morally obligated to genetically modify their children. That, to me, smacks of this scientism that C.S. Lewis warns us about.
It's definitely, and in fact, we have a whole chapter on the transhumanist movement, of which Savulescu is a part, about these people, prominent scholars in places like Oxford, who want us to breed a superhuman race. And you know, they don't particularly believe that God existed, but they think that human beings can engineer themselves to become gods or godlike. And it is frightening, and this is precisely what C.S. Lewis was warning about in the 1940s and 50s, and now you have this real push. And like I said, the broader movement is known as transhumanism, but Savulescu is certainly a prominent proponent and actually features prominently in one of the chapters of our book.
What does that mean, transhumanism? Define that a little bit, or flesh that out.
They think that basically evolution should not stop, and so we should evolve and transcend our current humanity and you know, even be hybrid with the qualities, you know, throughout nature of, and breed basically a higher human that makes today's human look like apes look to us, and that we can do this through genetic engineering, and that we should do this, and that if we don't do this, the human race will be destroyed. And
this sounds like a bad science fiction movie.
Yes, and in fact, and if these people weren't at such elite institutions in the academic mainstream, you'd say, oh, these are just cranks. The really scary thing is that these people are at elite institutions, and they're not just on the fringes. Yeah. I wish they were.
Wow. All right, we're talking right now with John West. John, I know your time is limited, so when you have to go, just tell me, but I'll just go until you tell me you can't talk anymore. And John's written this book, or actually edited this book and written some of the essays in it, called The Magician's Twin. For all C.S. Lewis fans, this is great. C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. Now, going back to this scientism, what about the Holocaust? I mean, that whole thing was science run amok. The abuse, talk about the abuse of science, the goal to create a master race and kill all these people like Jews and gypsies and Slavs that they thought were supposedly inferior subhumans. Amazing.
Yes, and in fact, that's important to bring out because part of the context of when Lewis is writing, those were the things that he was saying that really concerned him. And so, but the Nazi abuse of science, I mean, people forget, you know, I think one of the most scary things about the Nazi experience is not that there were, you know, crazy people like Hitler. It was that his whole society, especially the elites, the scientific elites, went along enthusiastically.
Yeah.
With a lot of what Hitler did, including the gassing of the handicapped, and it was horrible, and you know, but this was elite culture, the most sophisticated world civilization, trained many of the people in American graduate schools, and so when Lewis saw that science could be abused in that situation, and saw some of the same ideas that there were British eugenists. This is also what the Nazis did, you know, breeding better human beings using Darwinian principles and trying to get rid of those who they regarded as unfit, who would have been killed off by natural selection, but now we've been too compassionate, and so we were sinning against natural selection, so we had to get back to the good old days. Lewis saw this happening and people arguing and making these arguments in Britain and in non-totalitarian countries, and he said, look, this is something that would be devastating for us. And so, yeah, but that was the context. And also Soviet Russia, because you had the abuse of science and the psychiatric wards against, you know, people who believed in God being declared basically, you know, psychologically unfit, because that was a psychological illness to believe in God, and the misuse of psychiatry and things. And Lewis was also concerned about that.
You know, going back to the abuse of science, let's talk just real quick about the Soviet Union. I saw an article, and I only saw it once, and it was only reported on once, but that supposedly Stalin himself had even wanted to see if there was some way to breed, talk about transhumans, to breed human beings with gorillas to make them good fighting machines.
I do recall when that came out, and I think that is true. I don't know a lot about it. It doesn't shock or surprise me because of the sort of experiments that were going on at that time. And for those who actually have read, don't want to sort of give away the punchline, but in That Hideous Strength, Lewis's science fiction novel about this sort of stuff happening, it includes some stuff with basically an effort to revive, to cut off people's heads and then find a way to keep them alive. What's interesting, the Soviets actually did those experiments. They were doing them on dogs and things at the time Lewis wrote, and there was actually a propaganda film that a prominent English scientist, J.B.S. Haldane, that was one of Lewis's sparring partners, did, promoting these hideous experiments where they cut off the heads of creatures and then tried to, using tubes, keep them alive. I think that some of these experiments probably were hoaxes, but they were at least purported to be real. And this was actually the stuff that was prevalent in movie theaters at the time, you know, Lewis was writing. You could actually go on YouTube and actually watch this hideous Soviet propaganda film from the 1940s, hosted by this leading British geneticist from the 1940s.
Do you remember the name of the film, to find it?
It was, I think, Experiments on the Revival of Organisms, and J.B.S. Haldane, this leading British scientist, was the host.
How do you spell that name?
Haldane, H-A-L-D-A-N-E.
Wow. Okay. I mean, this is amazing. There was an old corny horror movie made in the early 60s, you know, The Brain That Wouldn't Die or something like that, you know, with the head in scientific test tube or whatever, where the body is gone, and then the mad scientist is trying to transplant that head onto a different body of another woman and so forth. But bottom line is, science run amok is very scary, but what's scary to me, John, and you probably know this more than anybody at the Discovery Institute, is the scientific establishment or portions thereof are trying to keep anybody with a Christian worldview out of their ranks and numbers, and so we won't have that kind of softening effect that Christianity can bring to the table.
Well, you know, that is true, and Lewis was very good on insisting that in science, just as in anything else, you need to follow the evidence where it leads. That, of course, that whole aphorism is kind of a motto of the intelligent design movement, but it actually comes from Plato, and Lewis adopted it, that statement, follow the evidence or follow the argument where it leads, for something called the Socratic Club that he ran while he was an academic at Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And so he really modeled that you need to be willing to debate and engage evidence, and it wasn't sufficient when some people who claim in the name of science, well, this ends it. What I'm saying goes, and you can't even question it, or you can't raise counter-evidence, or you're stupid, and we don't have to answer you. Lewis was great in skewering that sort of pretentiousness.
Well, we have some of that now with, for example, global warming. Look at global warming. This is settled science. You know,
we have it. And, you know, and this general idea of using science or claims in the name of science as a trump card, even the debate over whether religious institutions should have to, you know, provide abortion drugs or contraceptives has been done in the frame of one of our government officials, the head of Health and Human Services, when this whole mandate business was being debated. How did she justify it? Well, this is good science. That's actually what she said. And so that trumps religious liberty. You know, this is good science. Science is increasingly being used as a phony trump card in public policy that, you know, you can't challenge this because this is what science says, even if the policy really has nothing to do with science.
And that's interesting. And C.S. Lewis has something to say on this, and you've brought it all out in this book. Again, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. Do you have a website you want to promote for the book?
Yeah, I'd encourage people to go to csluisweb.com, where they can actually get more information about the book, download a free chapter on Lewis and intelligent design, and see a free video. We've done a 30-minute companion video with some of the people who contributed to the book about Lewis and scientism.
All right, John. Thank you so much. And what's the website for Discovery Institute?
Discovery.org.
Okay, and for those who may have seen the Ben Stein film, which was just terrific a few years ago, expelled. That was the, do you remember in the scenes where he was wandering around the streets of Seattle saying, hey, where's this Discovery Institute? He was looking for some sort of nefarious organization, and turns out it was on the eighth floor or something of some nondescript building.
Yeah. We've since moved, but we're in an even more nondescript building that's only like 3 stories high.
So. Oh, all right. But you're still continuing the nefarious work. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Hey, thank you so much, John. All the best to you.
Thank you, Jay.
Oh, I appreciate that. Bye now. That is John West of the Discovery Institute. Again, the name of his new book that he edited is called The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. Well, I have a few moments just to have some thoughts here, and I just want to bring out some aspects about the Holocaust, because I think that's a really important subject, and I think sometimes people miss some of the important messages related to the Holocaust. And we've alluded to some of them, but I just want to give a little bit of a chronology here. In the early 20s in Germany, there were some medical doctors before the rise of Adolf Hitler who were writing books along the lines of, there is such a thing as a life not worth living. And those ideas were circulating in some of the medical circles. When the Nazis took over, by the mid-1930s and late 1930s, they were able to actually implement some of the ideas that were brought out in that book, which, you know, talked about the, you know, the idea of a life not worth living. And what they did was they systematically killed off about 275,000 or so handicapped people. These were Germans. These were German citizens. Some of them were World War I veterans. Thank you for your service. Boom. Bye-bye. You're gone. Zyklon B gas, the notorious, nefarious gas that was used in the showers to gas Jews, millions and millions of them, that was developed first to kill off the handicapped, kill off the schizophrenic catatonic schizophrenic patients, and so forth. And so they killed, as I say, about 275,000 of these people, Germans, that they're in Germany, in Nazi Germany. And then later, of course, 1942, Hitler came up with what was called the final solution. Now, of course, they had, unfortunately, tragically, they took Jewish people and they trained them, you know, filled them in trains, and lots of people were dying and so forth, and they brought them all to all those different concentration camps. And they also brought gypsies, which would be the second largest subgroup of those who were killed. We know statistically about 6 million Jews were killed. And as far as the Gentiles that were killed in the Holocaust, those numbers vary. I've seen a number as low as 4 million, but I've seen another number as high as 11 million. We may never know the exact amount. Even if it was 6 million, 6 million, 6 million Jews, 6 million Gentiles, it's still an amazing, shocking number. But what people don't realize is the degree to which the Nazis were trying to create this master race. It was all about race. It was, let's clean up the gene pool, as they understood it. Let's have these pure, blonde, blue-eyed Aryans, you know, come out and rule the world. I mean, here was Hitler with his dark hair and dark eyes, and yet, you know, they were idolizing these blonde, blue-eyed people. But they were killing all these people systematically, and what a lot of people don't realize is what they assumed, what they had bought into in the Holocaust, were all the evolutionary assumptions and evolutionary teachings. In other words, what they were trying to do was speed up evolution. There's my line on this. The Nazi Holocaust was Darwinism on steroids. And so I think it's fascinating to see someone like C.S. Lewis, having lived through those times, and of course he was from Great Britain and they fiercely opposed the Nazis. He warned about the abuse of science in the 1940s and 1950s. He died, of course, in 1963. And this new book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, edited by John West, our guest, really helps put all this into perspective, especially C.S. Lewis's perspective on these things. And one last thought from C.S. Lewis, since Christmas is around the corner. I love this this thought. This is a paraphrase from C.S. Lewis. If Jesus had never been born, it would be always winter, but never Christmas. For Truth in Action Ministries and for GraceNetRadio.com, I'm Jerry Newcomb.